I'm Dori Smith for Regime Change Radio, a half-hour program about the importance of voting to bring about regime change in America. Today we will be taking a look at the 9/11 hearings on March 23rd and 24th with investigative journalist Dar Jamail. He was en route back to Iraq when we spoke with him. And Judd Legum, Deputy Director of Research at Center for American Progress. He talks about his group's reports online at americanprogress.org. As a grim backdrop to the 9/11 hearings in Washington, the anti-U.S. uprising has been intensifying, with Sunni and Shiite groups putting aside their differences to join in the fight against U.S. forces occupying their country. U.S. foreign policy expert Rahul Mahajan is in Iraq. He's writing home to his weblog, empirenotes.org, and says the people of Iraq are telling him that things are exactly the same in Iraq now as they were during Saddam Hussein's time, and possibly worse. Before the war, says Mahajan, at a meeting of the Arab League, Secretary General Ammar Moussa famously said that a U.S. war on Iraq would open the gates of hell. In Iraq, according to Rahul Mahajan, who is there, those gates are yawning wider than ever before, at least for the United States. The story of Fallujah is different when you're hearing it from Iraqi sources instead of American leaders, and Mahajan's description of events appears on his weblog, empirenotes.org. You can also read his piece called Opening the Gates of Hell in alternet.org, and we hope to be obtaining a live report from Iraq from Rahul Mahajan soon. Meanwhile, investigative journalist Dar Jamail is also in Iraq at this point. I asked him what he made of the climate in the U.S. and of the 9/11 hearings just before he left last week for the war zone. Dar, while you've been in this country again, have you been watching the news about the hearings? And if so, what's your take on Clark saying that the war has really delayed America's efforts where national security is concerned?
I watched some of the hearings, and I am really happy to see someone from within the administration come out and speak up about the horrible logic, and the word in quotes, of behind the war, of supposedly being the new front on the war on terror, and that this was going to help make us safer at home. That it's so clear now that it's only exacerbated the situation. I mean, terror threats are all over the place now. Simply look around and ask people, do they really feel more secure at home now in America than they do prior to the invasion? And especially from what I've seen over there, even today, looking at video of some of the carnage in Fallujah, where more contractors' vehicles have been destroyed, and watching just throngs of young Iraqis dancing around flaming vehicles and bodies and such. And it's really, you know, that there's generations of Iraqis that to say they have anti-American sentiment is very diplomatic. That people are enraged. They've suffered under the effects of the U.S. military and our foreign policy for decades over there, and now we've just taken the lid off at this point. And that, like I said, there's generations of people now that are seething, and people are coming not just from within Iraq, from other countries around the Middle East into Iraq to fight against the U.S. military there. And it seems like it's just a matter of time before more and more of this will start occurring on American soil.
We've had a horrible reaction in the Middle East to continued Israeli attacks there, more and more violent, up to the killing of Hamas leader Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. And we have yet to see the real consequences of that assassination. I'm very afraid of what will happen. And I'm sure many people in the region are just gnashing their teeth with worry at this point. Now, if you look at the IPS News, Interpress News Service, what you find is that there is worry that peace will get harder to find on the roadmap now in the Middle East, but that, too, the UN's credibility is at the breaking point. And there are analyses there by Thalif Deen at the UN on, again, IPS News Service, that things are just breaking down, that there won't be a way to climb back up the hill toward peace if things get any more out of control.
Well, you bring up some really good points, and I think with Sheikh Yassin's assassination, some of the biggest demonstrations that occurred in Iraq, and there were nationwide demonstrations throughout Iraq for several days after that assassination by the Israeli military. And Fallujah was actually one of the towns where they were the most vehement. There were cars being torched and mobs roaming the streets. And, I mean, the city was essentially shut down for hours at a time. And what we see happening there today, it's some of the venting coming out from that. And it's going to continue. And people, I think you're right, we haven't seen even the beginning of the worst of it because people are enraged and they read the news and they see the fact that the UN Security Council tried to pass a resolution condemning what Israeli military did in the assassination, and it was vetoed by the U.S. So they see this going on, and the Americans are right there in their country as occupiers, and so guess who the target's going to be, and guess who's going to get to feel the effects of the rage for the flawed policy, both in Israel as well as the U.S., and then they see it also playing out in their own home where the U.S. is using Israeli counterinsurgency tactics like collective punishment, home demolitions, and things like this on the Iraqis. So it's a situation where they're just throwing more and more gasoline on the fire, and I just keep asking myself, what's it going to take? I mean, when does it get bad enough to the, you know, where people back here will start going to the lengths they started to go during Vietnam. I mean, I know the U.S. soldier body count is still nothing compared to what it reached in the latter stages of Vietnam, and maybe it's going to take that point again. But from my perspective and my experience there and keeping in touch with everyone on the ground, it just seems like it's only going to keep getting worse and spiraling out of control the more time goes by.
Investigative journalist Dar Jamail. You can read his reports online at newstandardnews.net. We expect him to be on Regime Change Radio again soon. Judd Legum provides 9/11 hearings analysis next. He spoke with us March 26th, shortly after the testimony of Secretary of State Colin Powell, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, Director of Central Intelligence George Tenet, and former counterterrorism chief Richard A. Clark. At the time, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice was still refusing to testify under oath. She has since agreed to do so, and we will hear portions of her testimony today at the end of this program. Judd Legum is Deputy Director of Research at the Center for American Progress.
I think there's been a lot of misinformation about what the government has or what the Bush administration specifically was or wasn't planning prior to 9/11. As recently, in recent days, we've been hearing that, in fact, there was a military plan by the Bush administration, or at least in the works, from the Bush administration to take out al-Qaeda. But then the Deputy Secretary of State, Armitage, in the commission hearings themselves, admitted that the military options weren't put in until after the September 11th tragedy. It just says to me that, basically, that the administration feels that they are under attack, and they're pretty much willing to say whatever they feel they need to say to parry this attack, whether or not it's true or not.
Now, I want to have a discussion with you about the criminality at hand here. We're talking about an administration that is accused of lying, that is accused of misrepresenting itself in the war, so-called war on terror, and the reasons for framing things that way in Iraq. These are charges that go a long way in our democratic system toward the impeachment realm, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think even more than impeachment, it comes down to really a fundamental question of can you trust the people who are running the government, and really who is the government run for? And I think that this administration is, through these hearings, is developing a considerable credibility gap with the American people. I don't know if at this point, impeachment is a reality of something that is likely to happen. But I can certainly say that the facts that are emerging are going to raise serious questions in the minds of Americans who are paying attention, and I think a lot of Americans are paying attention.
And a lot of Americans made the connection, because the White House said they should, between Iraq's leader Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. Talk a little bit about how you've learned about that subject in your research.
Well, this was a really a very systematic campaign by the administration to conflate really what are two real but separate problems of Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. And the president at one point said that you can't make any distinction between the two. And then, of course, you had Arlen Specter, the senator from Pennsylvania, deny on CNN just last weekend that they ever claimed there were ties. And so there's really a lot of back and forth on this issue, and I think it's really a deliberate attempt to confuse the issue, because the administration, despite the facts, would very much like there to be a connection between Iraq and al-Qaeda.
Well, going back to that time last year when the White House was arguing its case for war, we had weapons inspectors that were in Iraq, and we had the government of Iraq handing over documents that were so extensive that they really couldn't possibly have had time to examine them all in the time that it took to get back to us, the American people, that the response was insufficient. Let's go back to that point and talk about how the White House did frame their arguments for war.
Well, I think when they framed the arguments for war, it was very much an issue of that we needed to attack now because there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And they were claiming that those weapons of mass destruction were presenting an urgent, a grave, a gathering threat, and that that was the justification for action. And now subsequently, when it turns out that those weapons were not there, as confirmed by their own weapons inspector, David Kay, and it hadn't been there for many years, now the administration is presenting other justifications for the war: humanitarian concerns, promotion of democracy. But this is not the case that was brought to the American people, and the record on that is very clear.
And so it does seem that some of what is being said is a little bit of a backtrack from that position that the White House had taken. And if we go on your website, the Center for American Progress, we see the headline of one of your daily progress reports is "Bush admits negligence. President implicitly acknowledges ignoring intelligence warnings." Talk a little bit about the Center for American Progress and that report and where you're going with that headline.
Yeah. Well, what we do at the Center for American Progress every day, and this is something that I'm involved in, is we put out a publication called the Progress Report. You can find it online at progressreport.org. And what we were referring to then is the president said, had I known that terrorists were planning to attack the United States with airplanes, I would have done something about it. But the facts show, and this has been reported, that there were warnings given to the intelligence community of the United States for years that terrorists were considering just such an attack.
We're talking with Judd Likem. He's the research director at the Center for American Progress. Let me ask you what documents you're reviewing when you discuss these facts. I'm looking at an August memo focused on attacks in U.S., an article by Bob Woodward and Dan Egan, May 18. This is 2002. What memos, what articles, what documents are you referring to?
Well, when we produce the reports, we go back, we look at reports in the press, and it's amazing what you can find out just by reviewing what was in the press, the mainstream media, the last 3 or 4 years, and compare it to what the administration is saying today, just comparing what they're saying now to what they were saying then. But we also, look at the primary sources. We look at transcripts. We look at reports by other nonprofit organizations. We look at reports produced by the government. We really try to encapsulate the whole body, the whole range of information in our reports, really in an attempt to put the news of the day, the things you're reading on the headlines, in a context so that you can get a deeper understanding of them.
Mm-hmm. Now, the 1999 report that's mentioned here, prepared for the National Intelligence Council, which is an affiliate of CIA, and that warned that terrorists associated with bin Laden might hijack an airplane and crash it into the Pentagon, White House, or CIA headquarters. To what extent should the White House have taken that kind of level of report more seriously?
Well, I think that the record shows, and I would encourage all your listeners to, if they haven't already, to see if they can find a way to see Dick Clark's testimony in front of the commission, because I thought it was really outstanding and quite powerful. And what he does is he reviews the record, and it really illustrates that really from right when this administration came into office, they downgraded terrorism as a priority. And you don't have to take Dick Clark's word for it or anybody else's word for it. You can take the president himself. In Bob Woodward's book, Bush at War, he says that before 9/11, there wasn't a sense of urgency about it for him.
This really goes to the heart of the matter of the discussions at hand in these 9/11 hearings that were provoked really by families who wanted to know and wanted public debate and wanted public exposure for the dialogue about what happened and what went wrong. But these hearings reveal a very deep set of changes in Washington when it comes to intelligence under the administration of George W. Bush. And I would cite one example here where the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, George Tenet, said that he had daily meetings at the White House with the president.
Well, I mean, I think that is a decision that the president made, and that might have been an appropriate way for him to get information. What Dick Clark was really saying is he was trying to get the president's attention and get the cabinet and get the the upper levels of the national security, the NSC, to listen to him. And under the Bush administration, he couldn't. George Tenet certainly had the president's attention, but Dick Clark didn't. And Dick Clark didn't have the attention of the people he needed to get attention, and he was trying. And I think that's what the testimony for the commission has really shown.
It does imply that the head of CIA went directly to the president, and that in that sense, all the normal channels were bypassed. In other words, the people that normally would be standing in line in order to translate intelligence information and put it in some context were missing from the equation, right?
I think there were serious problems, but I almost think that the opposite was true, that he really wasn't getting enough of the actual data, and that he was getting the information, spun to him by, people like Richard Perle in the Department of Defense, where they set up their own intelligence agency, and that really he wasn't getting, or at least wasn't listening to, the facts as that the intelligence were suggesting, that was contained in the intelligence. He was getting the neoconservative spin. And I really think that was the heart of the problem. That includes Richard Perle, that includes Paul Wolfowitz, who's been in front of the commission, that includes Condi Rice, who hasn't been in front of the commission publicly, who have really been calling for the use, and some would say abuse, of American power to overthrow countries like Iraq long before 9/11, long before there was any, inspections. This is a long-standing agenda that they've had, and there's an extensive record that backs that up.
And where Condoleezza Rice has been speaking privately, is she at all, do you think, discussing things on the same level that she would publicly? I mean, we don't know what they're talking about, and we can't really play guessing games about it. We do know the topic, though, and I mean, since they're putting all the facts out there the way they are, why couldn't she be public too?
Well, she's really undermined any argument she has, because her argument essentially, she is not confirmed by Congress. She's a private advisor of the president, and that her conversations with the president are confidential. But in spite of that argument, she has been gabbing all over the, you know, network news about just that information, her interactions with the president prior to 9/11, and making the case that, in fact, you know, the president was very focused on this this issue. So the real problem she's having here is that by launching this public relations campaign instead of testifying for the commission, she's really undermined her own justification for not appearing.
And what do you think will come to pass between now and June when the second round of public hearings begins? What kinds of developments do you think could occur, and how might they be impacted by, let's say, what the White House is doing abroad in its prevention doctrine?
Well, I think that one thing that's happening and that this commission has really helped do already is that a lot of the details about what's going on, the picture is becoming clear about just what happened in the months preceding 9/11. And I think that as that picture becomes clear, more and more people are going to be asking questions about whether they can trust this administration on national security issues. And I think people are becoming, you know, there's an increasing appetite for someone to talk straight for them. And I think that's why you see the reception that Dick Clark's been getting. And it was really dramatically illustrated at the commission the other day when, you know, he was very visibly, you know, embraced by all of the victims' families who were there.
Judd Legum of the Center for American Progress. I'm Dori Smith. You're listening to Regime Change Radio, produced at WHUS Stores. You can write to me with your comments at rcrradio@aol.com. We close our program today, April 8, 2004, with a few segments of the testimony of Condoleezza Rice to the 9/11 Commission, first to Commissioner Benveniste, then to Commission member Jamie Gerlich, on the issue of who was informing the president and what did the president do about it.
Do you believe that had the president taken action to issue a directive to the director of CIA to ensure that the FBI had pulsed the agency to make sure that any information which we know had been collected, we know now had been collected, was transmitted to the director, that the president might have been able to receive information from CIA with respect to the fact that two Al-Qaeda operatives who took part in the 9/11 catastrophe were in the United States, Al-Hazmi and Mihdhar, and that Mousawi, who was not even made, who Dick Clark was never even made aware of, who had been, who had jihadist connections, who the FBI had arrested, and who had been in a flight school in Minnesota trying to learn the avionics of a commercial jetliner, despite the fact that he had no training previously, had no explanation for the funds in his bank account, and no explanation for why he was in the United States, would that have possibly, in your view, in hindsight, made a difference in the ability to collect this information, shake the trees, as Richard Clark had said, and possibly interrupt the plotters?
My view, Commissioner Benveniste, as I said to Chairman Cain, is that, first of all, the Director of Central Intelligence and the Director of the FBI, given the level of threat, were doing what they thought they could do to deal with the threat that we faced. There was no threat reporting of any substance about an attack coming in the United States. And the director of the FBI and the director of the CIA, had they received information, I am quite certain, given that the director of the CIA met frequently face-to-face with the President of the United States, that he would have made that available to the President or to me. I do not believe that it is a good analysis to go back and assume that somehow maybe we would have gotten lucky by, quote, shaking the trees. Dick Clark was shaking the trees. I'm director of Central Intelligence was shaking the trees. The director of the FBI was shaking the trees. We had a structural problem in the United States.
Did the president meet with the director of the FBI?
We had a structural problem in the United States. And that structural problem was that we did not share domestic and foreign intelligence in a way to make a product for policymakers, for good reasons, for legal reasons, for cultural reasons, a product that that people could depend upon.
Did the president meet with the director of
FBI
between August 6th and September 11th?
I will have to get back to you on that. I'm not certain.
That commission said we are going to get hit in the domestic United States, and we are going to get hit big. That's number one. And number two, we have big systemic problems. The FBI doesn't work the way it should, and it doesn't communicate with the intelligence communities. Now, you have said to us that your policy review was meant to be comprehensive. You took your time because you wanted to get at the hard issues and have a hard-hitting, comprehensive policy. And yet there is nothing in it about the vast domestic landscape that we were all warned needed so much attention. Can you give me the answer to the question why?
I would ask the following. We were there for 233 days. There had been recognition for a number of years before, after the 93 bombing and certainly after the millennium, that there were challenges, if I could say it that way, inside the United States, and that there were challenges concerning our domestic agencies and the challenges concerning the FBI and the CIA. We were in office 233 days. It's absolutely the case that we did not begin structural reform of the FBI. Now, the vice president was asked by the president, and that was tasked in May, to put all of this together and to see if we could put together, from all of the recommendations, a program for protection of the homeland against WMD, what else needed to be done. And in fact, he had hired Admiral Steve Abbott to do that work, and it was on that basis that we were able to put together the Homeland Security Council, which Tom Ridge came to head very, very quickly. But I think the question is, why over all of these years did we not address the structural problems that were there with the FBI, with the CIA, the Homeland Departments being scattered among many different departments? And why, given all of the opportunities that we'd had to do it, had we not done it? And I think that the unfortunate, and I really do think it's extremely tragic, fact is that sometimes until there is a catastrophic event that forces people to think differently, that forces people to overcome old customs and old culture and old fears about domestic intelligence and the relationship, that you don't get that kind of change. And I want to say just one more thing, if you don't mind, about the issue of high-level attention. The reason that I asked Andy Card to come with me to that meeting with Dick Clark was that I wanted him to know, wanted Dick Clark to know, that he had the weight not just of the National Security Advisor, but the weight of the Chief of Staff if he needed it. I didn't manage the domestic agencies. No National Security Advisor does. And not once during this period of time did my very experienced crisis manager say to me, you know, I don't think this is getting done in the agencies. I'd really like you to call them together or make a phone call. In fact, after the fact, on September 15th, what Dick Clark sent me, and he was my crisis manager, what he sent me was a memorandum or an email that said, after national unity begins to break down, again, I'm paraphrasing, people will ask, did we do all that we needed to do to arm the domestic agencies, to warn the domestic agencies, and to respond to the possibility of a domestic threat? That, I think, was his view at the time, and I have to tell you, I think given the circumstances and given the context and given the structures that we had, we did.
That was Condoleezza Rice testifying today, April 8th, to the 9/11 Commission hearings in Washington, D.C. to first Commissioner Benveniste, next 9/11 Commission member Jamie Gerlach.